Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white open long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and I am the host of this podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I am also a newly minted USA Today bestselling author of the novel Blank. I've created a whole community of book lovers around this podcast, a publishing company, reading retreats, a bookstore, and more. Learn more at zibbymedia.com or follow me on social at Zibby Owens or join the community at Zibby Readers. Anna Quinlan is back on the podcast. I am such a huge fan, as anyone listening to this podcast knows. I am just over the moon excited, in love with everything she does. After Annie is her latest novel, and it is my Zibby's book club pick. So on March 22nd, if you are in LA, you can come to Zibby's bookshop and see her in person with our book club there with the local chapter. And she will be part of the Zibby's virtual book club, which you can learn about on bookclubs.com when you find Zibby's virtual book club, or on zibbymedia.com, go to the book club section and you will find the information. And I'll also probably post about it. So anyway, Anna Quinlan is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller lists. She is the author of many novels: Object Lessons, One True Thing, Black and Blue, Blessings, Rise and Shine, Every Last One, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, and Miller's Valley. Her memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, published in 2012, was a number one New York Times bestseller. Her book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has sold more than a million copies. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize and published two collections, Living Out Loud and Thinking Out Loud, which, by the way, if you have not read, you should go back and read, because although they were written years ago, there are timeless messages that everybody should read. Her Newsweek columns were collected in Loud and Clear. Welcome, Anna. Thank you so much for coming back on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. We were just joking. I feel like you've been on this 100 times already. To discuss After Annie, which is my Zibby's book club pick. I just love this book so much. I love your writing so much. And oh my gosh, everything about it. So Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for picking it, Zibby. I'm so honored and pleased, and I can't wait to do the book club meeting with you.
Yay. Also the color. I feel like I dressed for you today. I'm wearing a light blue sweater. I can just loan it to you if you want to take it on the road.
I must say, I love the cover of this book, and we fought pretty hard for it. There were a lot of different iterations. Cover art is hard.
Yeah. Well, this is about, it's so much interior life, right? It's about relationships and the intimacies and the effects of one thing, but it's about a person. I would imagine this would be a tough brief, because it could go in so many ways for the cover, but it's gorgeous.
Exactly.
Really gorgeous. And speaking of that, so can you tell listeners what After Annie is about?
Sure. I don't feel like it's a spoiler because in the first sentence on the first page, Annie Brown dies. And she's a young wife and mother. She has four young kids. She's been married quite happily to a guy named Bill. And her best friend is named Anne-Marie. And the book is about the first year in their lives without her. How Bill copes or doesn't. How Allie, who is 13 years old, has to step up. And how Anne-Marie is completely lost without her closest friend. But I think what I wanted to communicate with the book and what I feel pretty happy about succeeding at is Annie dies on the first page and she's the most alive person in the book. And I think that that's something that we don't often appreciate about grief and loss. That when we have beloved people in our lives, it's sometimes easy to overlook them on a day-to-day basis. Yes, there she is, the bedrock of everything that I do. And then if they die, when they die, they loom larger somehow in our minds, in our hearts, in our daily lives than they might have done when they were actually there. And I think that's what happens for all three of these people. The way that they get through this first year is that Annie is still very much there for all of them.
Oh, well, writing about it, reading it as a mom of four myself and everyone who reads it, you can put yourself in the shoes of basically every character, right? That what would happen what would happen to everyone we love when if we were to disappear like today, right? How would everybody react? Would they be okay? I feel like there's so much of that worry, are your kids going to be okay? What are they going to think about? And this is like, it's almost like an exercise in handling anxiety, right? Like if this were to happen, would everyone be okay?
Well, and I think what you realize, and certainly what's true in the novel, is that people get through in different ways. I mean, each of the four children respond in quite different ways to what has happened. Bill is almost frozen, not only because he loved his wife so very much, but because he has overlooked the fact that basically their entire life is engineered by her. Mm-hmm. Duh. Hello. Do we all live with this? And Anne-Marie just has never been able to imagine a life without Annie riding shotgun with her since they were both kids. So everybody has to try to recover some different piece of themselves. And I think that's what happens in life when in a family, a man loses his wife, children lose their mother, and friends lose the person who held them all together.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I know, sadly, you lost your mother at a younger age. How much of that was a piece of this?
It wasn't at all a piece of this. And it's been so long. I was 19 when my mother died. I'm 71 years old now. You may or may not be able to figure out that this book is dedicated to my mother. It just has her initials, which is how I wanted it. I sort of felt like it was time to put that overweening influence to bed, even though it will be an overweening influence until the day I die. But this grew much more out of that sense that you develop as you get older, that the landscape of your personal earth starts to shift. Mm. I mean, I am 71 years old, which means over the last 10 years, a fair number of my friends have died. And that's challenging. And you think about how we get on without them. And I'm also always interested. The only thing that really interests me as a novelist, and actually it was the only thing that really interested me as a reporter and a columnist, is the ordinary lives of ordinary people. And having said that, the ordinary lives of ordinary people, which are often lived with a valor and a courage and a depth that gets overlooked amid the literati, the intelligentsia. I'm not interested in writing about people who have lives of that sort, although there are very good books written about them. I'm really interested in the everyday pushing of the rock uphill.
Interesting. Do you feel like that's your everyday sometimes, just like getting through?
Yes, absolutely. I saw on Instagram, somebody was interviewing, was it Aretha Franklin? I think it was Aretha Franklin, and asked what her greatest challenge was. I'm going to get this wrong. Yeah. What her greatest challenge was. And she said, it's trying to figure out what to make for dinner every damn night. And I was like, yes, Aretha. It's not that my upper register is narrowed or that I can't figure out where to perform. It's what to make for dinner every damn night.
Oh my gosh, I love that. It's so great. Oh my gosh. So do you feel like this is, when you were writing it, were you trying to give a sense of hopefulness in that, yes, we all have these losses. We have people who will come in and come out of our lives and our lives will continue to shift. But ultimately, we have the ability to adapt in some way, even though it's not always pretty looking. Or is it that we need to take the time to acknowledge those we've lost and kind of sit with it a little bit and just, you know what I mean? Like, what do you want the reader to leave with?
Well, all of the above, but the difference between how the reader sees a piece and how you, when you're very much in it, see a piece is really interesting to me. I mean, I often say that readers tell me things about my own work that hadn't even occurred to me. And then yes, of course. So when I went into the first meetings with the people at Random House about this book, they were all talking about how the book is about resilience and how the book is about hope and how the book is about how we can lift each other up. And I went, the book is about grief and loss. And they all said, yes, 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 but. And that but made me think about what I'd done here in a way that I hadn't thought about it before, except for the fact that at the very end, there's clearly a moment where there's hope with a capital H and hope with a small H. And that was, I think, probably my way of saying, in different ways, for better or worse, everyone will survive and even thrive, but maybe not right now, and maybe not for all of them right now. So I think that reaction that the book was about successfully pushing the rock uphill made me look at it in a slightly different way. Hmm.
Do you have an Anne Marie in your life?
Oh, yes.
And who is your Anne Marie?
Her name is Janet Maslin. She was for many years the chief film critic and then the chief book critic of the New York Times. And she is definitely my Anne Marie, although I haven't known her as long as Anne Marie and Annie have known each other. I mean, those friendships where you've known each other since elementary school. Well, I think you have one, don't you?
I do. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. those are powerful because they go way back to before you were you, mm-hmm, in some kind of way, or maybe when you're 7 and 8, you're more you than you are at 17, and then you become you again. But those are really powerful relationships. And most of the women I know have, if not a best friend, then several best friends. And certainly the ones I know who are living their best lives have a coterie of girlfriends that are critical to them.
This is this whole like, is marriage important? Like, could we all just go live with our girlfriends forever? You know, type of, you know, I feel like there's this movement, like Gallant, I don't know, I just read about it somewhere too, like people are just deciding, I'll just live with my girlfriends forever. Like, why not?
Well, I think the piece of the whole attitude towards marriage now that I find a little perplexing is the whole, my husband is my best friend, because I feel like your best friend plays one role in your life and your spouse plays a different role. It's not more or less, it's just different. And I find that whole best friend, spouse conflation a little confusing from my point of view. But I think the living with your best, with your girlfriends thing also arises when you get older, because the truth is that women tend to live longer than men. I'm part of a women's travel group. We just got back from Rome. I love them all so much. And we talk all the time about the home. The home will be one of our second homes, and then we will hire. There's apparently plans for a male massage therapist, definitely a cook, maybe a nurse if we need it, and all of us just sitting around, you know, being snarky.
I mean, I feel like that could be your next book. That sounds really good.
Well, actually, the novel I'm working on now has a four-woman book club in it, but the rule of their book club is that you cannot read the book. Everybody gets the book, but you can't read the book. Book club is just to sit around and talk about what's going on in your own life. And I'm kind of charmed by that idea, even though I do love book clubs that read the book, because sometimes they read my books.
I was somewhere recently and somebody like got up to ask the author a question. And she's like, well, I haven't actually read your book, but blah, 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 blah. And the author was like, you know what? You bought it. That's great. I don't even care if you read it. It makes no difference to me. Wait, don't be embarrassed. You help me out. It's so funny. Well, after you write a book like this, where Anne-Marie and Bill and the kids and everybody is so real that you feel, I mean, as a reader, I feel like I know them intimately. And as the creator and whatever, however imagination works, like, do you feel sort of adrift? Do you imagine like what they would do in certain situations in your life? Like, do they kind of, you know, prance along with you as you go about the day in some way, or do you just put them to bed and close the book and sort of set it aside?
I feel a little bit like it's like moving from one town to another. Mm. When you move away and you sort of keep in contact with people, but it's not the same kind of contact. And after a while, it usually ebbs and dries up. I sort of feel like I moved to another town. Having said that, when they're real, they're real. I mean, I remember being at a stoplight in the car with the kids one day, and this woman in a nurse's uniform with red hair walked across the street. And I reflexively thought, that's Fran Flynn. Now, Fran Flynn is the protagonist of Black and Blue. She is a nurse. She does have red hair, but she does not actually exist outside of the pages of that book in my imagination. And yet, in some ways, during the course of writing that novel, she had become so real to me that, as a matter of course, I thought I could identify her on the street. And I sort of feel that way about Annie. Sometimes I drive past an assisted living place out here in Pennsylvania where I live sometimes, and I'm not exactly that specific, but there is this sense that Annie's working there, you know, that kind of thing. So there's those peripheral moments that kind of come out of nowhere and hit you.
Interesting. You also sort of tackle addiction in part in this book.
Yes.
Talk about that, and, you know, what are we even to do with the rise of, you know, so many people struggle with this all the time, and it impacts so many families and relationships.
Well, it's one of the things that I love the most about Annie, that Anne-Marie can't snooker her. Mm-hmm. And that if she were a lesser person, at a certain point, she would cut that cord. And of course, that's a real temptation to just say, enough, I can't take any more, you know? But Annie is such a good person and such a good friend that she's the person who really grapples with this and pulls Anne Marie out of a hole. And I love that. I love that about her. And of course, then later on, after Annie's gone, Anne Marie really is in a head to relapse. And it's only some sense of a possible future that brings her back from the brink. I mean, all addiction, all addicts are different. And one of the things that you worry about creating a character like this is that people are going to say, oh, but it's not like that. She couldn't get over it by X, or she couldn't work it through it by Y. I mean, this is one woman who has fallen into a pit that a lot of other people have fallen into. And by dint of great love, manages to surmount it. One hopes, I'm crossing my fingers here, forever. But forever's a long time, especially when you're jonesing.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it. And that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
I loved Annie's creative approach to basically making her.
She's such a hard type sometimes. That's what I really like about her, that every once in a while, you know, she's being nice and she's doing things and everything. And then every once in a while, she's just like, okay, stop that right now. You know, she's pushed to the edge of herself. And I love that about her.
Yeah, amazing. You've been writing your whole career, and you're still coming up with new characters and new ideas and speaking with passion about your projects. Like, is this just who you are deep down, that you will, oh, this is just sort of part of you, a big part of you is just this continual creativity and storytelling. And, you know, does it ever end? Do you ever say like, well, I don't know, I don't want to do this anymore? Or, you know, how do you feel about it?
Well, as you know, in my remarks at your Zibby event,
Thank you for doing that.
I indicated quite strongly that I find this very difficult.
Yes.
And that I do not love it. I'm always agog at all those writers who are like, this is my happy place. No, my happy place is with a cup of coffee and, you know, the crossword puzzle. And that day, I think I said something that I've come to very slowly over a period of time, which is that one of the reasons I keep going, because of course I don't really run out of ideas. I mean, the world of human beings is an infinite place, which gives you a lot of characters to work with. But the work is hard enough that what keeps me going is that I don't feel like writing is something I do. I feel like writing is who I am. But then I thought about it in a whole different way this week in this interregnum. Right before publication, which is just a horrible period.
Could you brand that more? Could that just become the term that everybody uses, the interregnum? Oh my gosh, I love that. Love.
You know, when the book is sitting there, when my box of books is sitting there and I'm thinking, will anybody care? You know, it's pre-publication is just horrible for me. But in this interregnum, I was reading a series of mystery novels by a woman who has been somewhat lost in the mist of time called Elizabeth Daly. She wrote a series of more than a dozen novels starring a documents guy named Henry Gamache. The last one was published in 1950, and she was always said to be Agatha Christie's favorite mystery novelist, which makes you wonder why she's been lost in the mist of time. Anyhow, I finished one the other night, and I went to get the next one, and there isn't a next one. And I thought, wait, you know, I've been with Henry for a month now. What's going on? So I looked up her bio thinking, oh, this is terrible. Elizabeth Daly finished this book and then she died. But she didn't. She lived for another 17 years. And I have no idea why she gave up on this series. But what it made me think about was that every writer, whether they want it or not, whether they honor it or not, whether they accept it or not, has an intimate relationship with readers. I mean, when I sit at the computer and work, I felt this particularly keenly when I was a columnist. It's like I'm in a conversation, but I can't see the person on the other side of the computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And realizing that I wanted more of these books and that I somehow felt it wasn't fair for Elizabeth Daly to have left me in the lurch in this way, I realized that part of why I continue to do this is that I have a relationship with readers that I've built over almost 50 years. And I almost have an obligation to maintain that relationship. And I've never thought of it that way before. Although I'm surprised I haven't thought about it when I'm on book tour because I meet so many readers and it's so gratifying to talk to them about what they see in the work.
Wow. So you just feel obligated, basically. This is all just, you know, you might as well. No, I'm kidding. I see what you're saying, obviously. And it's true. I mean, I would be very disappointed if you stopped writing.
Look, but I mean, when both Philip Roth and Alice Munro announced at age 80 that they were done, I kind of envied them. Now, I mean, both of them had won endless prizes, are considered near the top of the canon, are both writers whose work I admire greatly. But I thought, gee, you know, what's Alice going to do? Is she just going to like knit and hang out with her friends?
More trips to Rome. Yeah. Well, also, I mean, don't you feel in part that all of this lends life a greater sense of purpose in a way? Or is that just, you know, like there's like a reason? I don't know.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, I can't remember how many years ago it was meeting with the financial advisor. And he said, now, at what age do you anticipate retiring? And then he took one look at my face and said, okay, next question. because I can't imagine that. Now, having said that, I have lots of other moving parts to my life that take up a lot of time. I mean, I'm on a couple of boards. I really believe in public service, and I try to always put my body where that belief is. And obviously, I have children and grandchildren and a great group of friends, and I'm an inveterate reader. I mean, it's basically my favorite thing to do, except to hang out with my children and my grandchildren. So I have lots of other things to fill parts of my life, but I'm very invested in work. And I think probably I will be doing it ad infinitum.
Do you ever think about, and I know you're more active now on Instagram, which I love getting these little sneak peeks and your funny sayings and, you know, all of it.
Did not want to do that. 10 years ago, Random House said, you've got to join Twitter. And I was like, I'm not joining Twitter. I drew a line in the sand. And then with this book, they said, and it was with Write for Your Life. You've got to join Instagram. And I sort of drew a line in the sand. And then my daughter said to me, Mommy, you should do Instagram. It's not like Twitter. It's not mean-spirited, and it's kind of fun. And then she said the magic words, and you'll be able to promote other people's books. And I thought, that's it. I'm promoting other people's books. And I actually enjoy it a lot more than I expected to, although I spend way too much time looking at puppies.
They are cute. My kids do that all the time on my phone. So my feed is all, you know, I'm like, what?
Exactly.
You know, they must think I am so crazy with all the things my kids start looking at and I start looking at it. Oh my gosh. But anyway, aside from Instagram, when you used to write a column and have that relationship and conversation, do you ever think about doing more of that type of the immediacy of the like daily life chronicling that is not just really daily life? It's really about so much more than that.
No, I feel like I wrote a column to the best of my ability. First, when I was doing Life in the 30s, and then when I did the op-ed page column for the Times and the back page of Newsweek, but I really thirst for more of that kind of material from younger people.
Interesting.
I feel like we baby boomers have clogged every pipeline imaginable, as we now can all tell by how the presidential race is shaping up. And that really, I want to hear from people in their 30s and 40s and 50s from all kinds of backgrounds about what their lives are like. I feel like, you know, I did my bit. I communicated with readers in that way. I communicate with them now through fiction and the occasional nonfiction book. But in terms of that kind of column and essay work, I want to hear from younger, more diverse voices.
Great answer. Okay. Last thing, advice to aspiring authors, maybe the 30, 40, 50-year-old who is trying to get out there in the way that you're suggesting.
First of all, I feel your pain. Oh my God. Well, I mean, I had a real leg up here because I was working at the Times and I was doing this column. So Random House never said, gee, you know, can she write a sentence that people will read? And they never said, can she bring it on home? Because I brought it on home, you know, twice a week and all that. So I had that as my underpinnings to any kind of book deal. But what I would say, first of all, is the reason they call it voice is because it's supposed to sound like the way you talk. I see way too much prose where somebody feels like this is what writing sounds like. It sort of smacks of the MFA program or the writing workshop. And in the process, the person has lost what makes them unique. I mean, what makes you unique is the only thing really worth publishing, because there's so much out there. So don't lose sight of your own voice. What may be your own quirkiness, your own craziness? Oh my God, is anybody going to publish this? Well, David Foster Wallace got published. So, you know, quirky, crazy, whatever. And the other thing is, you can't, you know, we were talking before about doing the work. You can't spend too much time blue skying this. You got to sit down every day and you got to look at the screen. And if you're like me, every time you look at the screen, you are seized by insecurity, self-doubt, and fear. it won't be good. I can't do this. What am I doing? You know, and then you just have to start to type. You just have to start to type. And, you know, as I've said in the past, my experience is that sometimes bad writing leads to good writing, but not writing doesn't lead to anything. And it's just really important to just sort of pound it out. And then my senior year at Barnard in the creative writing program, the BJ Shute, the novelist who was teaching us, gave us our first assignment. We're all waiting. Buy manila envelopes. We were not expecting that. And buy manila envelopes was so we could send things out. And we weren't expecting that either. I think all of us thought, oh, we're writers, we're writing. None of us thought you put it in the envelope and you send it to a magazine and they send it back to you with a form letter that says, you're a terrible writer. I mean, it never says that, but that's what you think it says. So you got to get used to the idea that you're going to try to go out there either on the internet, through a zine, through a publishing house, and find readers. And you've got to get used to the idea that person after person after person is going to turn you down. I mean, you know, the first Harry Potter book was turned down by how many? Jane Austen's father sent out the manuscript of Pride and Prejudice, which he was going to pay to have printed, okay, to a London publisher, returned by post, I think it said, or returned on receipt by post or something. It was just like, it was like they hadn't even opened the envelope, you know? And there's a book that hasn't been out of print for 200 years. So, you know, there are people who will say to you, don't want it, don't like it. It's only one person's opinion. Again, pushing the rock uphill.
Coming full circle. I love it. Oh my gosh. Well, Anna, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Wait, can I add one thing, Zibby?
Of course.
Okay. So 6 or 7 years ago, 10 years ago, the conventional wisdom was that book publishing was on the skids. And at the same time, the conventional wisdom was that independent bookstores were all going under and being a bookseller was impossible. And in between that time and today, you started a publishing house and you opened a bookstore. And guess what? The conventional wisdom was wrong. And I think that when you buck conventional wisdom and win, you should walk around every day thinking, So that's my last word to you today, Zibby, is you should walk around today going, on behalf of all of us who write.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, and I'll just keep going into the wrong trending businesses. This is, I
do
guess,
it. Do. Do yeah. It. Yeah.
Maybe I'll take on, you know, the typewriter market next. Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Okay. Anna. I'll see you soon.
I'll see you soon. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you love it, please leave a review and follow us on social at Zibby Owens and at Zibby Readers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.